This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Bill Duke is a striking figure. He's a 6 feet, 4.5 inch tall African-American man with a shaved head. Maybe you saw him play opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger in Commando and Predator. Duke makes a good bad guy, but more often, he's on the other side of the camera directing. Duke's feature films include A Rage in Harlem and Deep Cover. And he spent years in television directing episodes of Falcon Crest, Hill Street Blues, and Miami Vice. Bill Duke's new film may seem like an unlikely choice for him. The Cemetery Club is the story of three middle-aged Jewish women who are widowed and find themselves once again out on the dating circuit. These lifelong friends are played by Olympia Dukakis, Ellen Burstyn, and Diane Ladd. Neither Duke nor any of his leading ladies are Jewish, so to keep the film accurate, Duke says they had a rabbi on the set at all times.
The irony is that the more research I did and the more I talked to the rabbi, the more I understood that these people were very much like my relatives and my mother and my aunts, that the ceremonies and rituals were a bit different. But fundamentally, we're talking about people that work for a living and raise children and have values and love and believe in friendships. And I think there's a universality about a certain class of people in any culture that basically do that.
You know what I really enjoyed was seeing a movie where middle-aged actresses had lead roles. It made me realize what an unusual experience that is.
I think you are unfortunately right.
I mean, did that interest you too, as someone that wants to get perhaps different faces up on the screen, that here was a chance to put in women that usually play supporting roles?
Well, not only that, but women that I have respected for a long time, actresses which I've wanted to see more of for years, like from Faye Dunaway to Ellen Burstyn. And they, and you know, after a certain period of time, you know, Hollywood sometimes is not very kind to women in that age range. And those talents, I think, are at their peak, and they're at the height of their acting form. They have had more experience of living. Some of them have had children. And I find something very beautiful in all of that, and something very rich in the very nature of that experience that is not being explored. And unfortunately, it continues to be ignored.
Well, you know what else I notice is that you use a lot of close-ups. The camera moves very close to their faces, and you do see the lines. There isn't necessarily the soft lighting. You see the creases around their mouth. Did you do that on purpose? Is that normally the way you work, to work very close-up?
Well, I had a long discussion with these ladies when I hired them, and I said, listen, I don't want to hide anything because I want to show the beauty of the aging face. I want to show the beauty of the experience of the person. So I don't want to gook it up with makeup and these filters that make you look like you're 20 miles away from the person, you know, to avoid. And everybody knows you're avoiding the fact that they have wrinkles in their face anyway, so I think it's kind of silly. But I wanted to utilize and exploit that. And I would say it's a courageous act on their part to allow me to do that. I mean, I thought in the bedroom scene, for example, that Ellen Burstyn was so sexy. I mean, you know, with that green dress on, and she and Danny. I mean, I thought it was passionate and erotic and sexy, and she played the woman of her age.
I'm speaking with director Bill Duke, and we're talking about a movie he has just finished, and it's coming out in the theaters, called The Cemetery Club, and it stars Ellen Burstyn, Olympia Dukakis, Diane Ladd, and Danny Aiello. As a black director, are you expected to do black movies? Are there pressures on you to do black movies?
Unfortunately, if your face is black in Hollywood, you are relegated for the most part to doing films, directing films that have black people in them. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but we should be allowed to choose the kinds of films and the kinds of genres of films that we wish to direct and be involved in. I am very happy with this particular experience because I was hired based upon my talent and not my ethnicity. And I must compliment the Walt Disney Company and David Hoberman and Bridget Johnson, those people there, because they had the courage to do so. They got a lot of phone calls, you know, once people knew I was directing this film. What the hell is this black guy doing directing this film about Jews? What does he have in common with them?
Where were the phone calls coming from?
Well, from, you know, people in the industry that didn't understand, you know. There were a lot of directors that were up for it that were Jewish, and a lot of women were up there for it, you know, and they were wondering, what's going on, you know. And Disney and I always responded, what qualified me was my humanity, and if that was very difficult for them to understand, then they would, and they didn't get the joke.
The pressures, though, for a black director to do movies that deal with black themes, is that a marketing decision? Does that come from producers? Does it come from critics? Does it come from the audience? Where do you feel the pressure the most?
I think it comes from all directions, but most particularly the studios, because in protecting their investment, I think in their minds, they would like to get people who have either experienced these dilemmas or subject matters or plots in their minds, or have some familiarity with the people who are being depicted in these films. And I think that because of that, their vision, their range of vision, is sometimes very limited. So that I would never be considered to direct, Star Wars 6, because obviously my vision of the world is limited to my community, I think, to a certain extent, as they see it.
This is the studio talking.
Yeah, because they don't see it, and so I have to, insist that my humanity transcends my ethnicity, and attempt in some way to change their minds. And if this film or any other films I do like this make money at the box office, not that they're critically acclaimed, because I think that's a secondary consideration, but if it makes money at the box office and makes a considerable profit, I think possibly that other directors of different ethnic hues will be allowed perhaps to do this.
You made your movie directorial debut with A Rage in Harlem.
Well, actually, it was one movie before that.
Oh, what was the movie?
And that was called The Killing Floor, which I directed for PBS. It was about the unionization of the Meatpackers Union in Chicago in the early 1900s.
Okay. You did make, though, A Rage of Harlem at the age of 48, is that right?
Yes.
Did you want to direct movies before then, but never had really been given the opportunity?
Yes. I wanted to direct features, in my 20s. But, it's been a long route for me, kind of like, I've gone around the long way to get back to the short way correctly, I guess you could say. But it's been a long time.
Well, you've made more than 100 television shows.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a detour for you, or is that just a way of getting in the movies? I mean, do you see that as time lost?
No, that's a double-edged sword television, yeah. Because it was an extremely wonderful training ground for me, because it enabled me to really have a great familiarity with the camera and work with actors and scripts and editing and pre-production and post-production and all the rest of that, over and over and over again. So I've gained a great deal of confidence in my ability to deal with the technical aspect of film through, television. At the same time, however, you can get stuck in television. The money is very, very good, and the residuals are even more wonderful. So you can create I created a lifestyle that I kind of got trapped by and detoured me in terms of, kind of like off of my original goal.
So you really didn't want to take the risk in movies for fear of losing your lifestyle?
Yes, exactly. And my lifestyle was exactly the thing I had to sacrifice in order. I was making a lot more money than I ever thought, yeah, I would make in television, and I was getting these physical ailments, headaches and backaches, and I went to the doctor and he said, "There's nothing wrong with you." Oh. He says, "Why don't you cut down on your work?" And a friend of mine said, "Why don't you just do what you really want to do?" So I gave up. I just stopped directing television except for maybe four, three or four or five shows a year. I was doing 12, 13 or so. And believe it or not, all these physical symptoms started to disappear. And I started doing PBS. I directed Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun and a thing called The Meeting by Jeff Stetson about a fictitious meeting between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And so, and those things are things that my heart was attached to. I went back to TV to do like movies of the week and, you know, things like pilots I really wanted to do. And once I think my heart was more involved in things, I began to get on track again. And then that's how I got my first feature, because a couple of feature producers saw my PBS work.
Well, what kind of a lifestyle are we talking about? How well were you living?
I had a Lloyd Wright house in the Hollywood Hills, and I had a nice big new Mercedes-Benz every couple of years. And it was like, you know, it's not bad.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we just have to take a very short break. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is director Bill Duke. He's made a number of movies, including A Rage in Harlem, and he was also, I'm looking here, also did Deep Cover with Larry Fishburne and Jeff Goldblum, and has appeared in a number of movies himself. We'll be talking a little bit more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with director Bill Duke. His latest movie, just out, is called The Cemetery Club. Now, my understanding is that your parents wanted you to be pre-med. Is that right?
Yes, and I very foolishly took some courses in which I failed miserably, you know, consecutively lower grades three separate times. So I kind of got the message that maybe that wasn't it. But I always saw this gleam in the eye of these people cutting up dogs and cats and, you know, sand sharks. And I thought they were a little mad, you know. And then they said, well, you know, because my mother and father only went to attended the second and third grade. And they had to work, you know. So education, the first kid in their family to go to college, was a mm-hmm. big deal. So you had to be something practical to make money and not have to go through the things they went through.
So how did you tell them that you weren't interested in this pre-med?
Well, my grades were so bad, I think they obviously kind of caught on to that, and they understood. So they said, well, the next best thing, since you want to be in the arts, well, you want, so be an English teacher. That's close enough. You write all the time. So if you're a teacher, you can always fall back on that. And I went to BU, and I had fallen asleep for the third time in my Chaucer class, and the teacher asked me to leave. And a friend who was my roommate, Israel Hicks, he said, you know, Bill, you've been talking about acting and writing for a long time. I got a friend, Lloyd Richards, who was a teacher over here in the School of the Arts. Why don't you audition? I said, I have nothing to lose, so I did. And I got in. And that next semester, you know, the gleam that I had seen in my classmates' eyes cutting up those dogs was in my eye. It was like coming home, you know. I was coming home to a feeling of, like, you know, I belonged. I was always, like, I felt weird outside of this environment.
You mentioned the fact that your parents really didn't even complete elementary school. Where did you live, and what kinds of jobs did they have? What was your childhood like?
Well, my childhood was both horrible and wonderful. I mean, I guess like everybody's is horrible and wonderful, but my images of my father was a man who was determined to take his family out of a relatively ghetto situation. So he actually, literally, believe it or not, got five jobs simultaneously from time to time.
He was working five jobs?
He would go into the foundry and work from 12 until 8 in the morning, and then he'd come from the foundry and he would go on the bread route. In those days, we had, you know, we delivered bread, and he'd work on the bread route for a couple of hours, and then he would go blacktopping. That is, you know, you have these steamrollers that repair potholes in the street, and he would be working the steamroller, and he would work on that for a while. Then he'd come home, and my mother would fix his lunch, dinner, so to speak, and she put this big board across this sitting chair he used to have. And my memories of my father are always with a half-finished meal in front of him, and he'd just fall asleep, you know, and never finished. You know, I don't think my father ever finished a meal in his life until he was much older.
So you never saw much of your father then growing up?
Not very much at all. And then on the weekends, the only time I would see him, and we were working, we would dig dry wells, which were like, you know, these ditches that were 6 to 8 feet deep and 3 to 4 feet wide that would be filled with stone. And then when it rained, the gutter would lead into this ditch, and it would disperse the water evenly throughout a lawn so that it wouldn't back up and to the foundation and erode the foundation of the house. Houses. And then we on the Sunday, my sister, my mother, and my father and I would clean bowling alleys. And so that was my childhood on that level. Then the other side of it was when we were very poor, which was almost a better time for us. We couldn't afford to go to the films. And I loved movies when I was a little kid. But my father felt bad about that, so he used to take us down to Main Street, Poughkeepsie, New York, and he'd make my mother pop a bag of popcorn, and we would sit in our car. And his way of making the movies for us would be, we'd watch people, and he would say, "What do you think that guy does, you know?" We say, "What do you mean?" And he would say, "Well, look at the shoes, how his shoes are worn on the sides, and look at the coat he's wearing, and, you know, how old is, you know, how much money do you think he makes?" And so, you know, it was a game we played that not until much later that I understood, you know, was shaping me into an actor and a filmmaker, which are really observers of people and reporters of people's behaviors.
Were your parents ever bitter at all about the condition of their lives?
Yes, I think they were very angry. You know, my father, you know, to a certain extent, I would say, was a racist. You know, I think my father and mother have seen, my father's deceased now, my mother's still living, but I think they'd both come from the South. My father's from Orange, Virginia. My mother's was from West Point, Mississippi. My father came to Poughkeepsie very early, and you know, they in the South in those days, you know, this is before Dr. King, you know. And my mother tells stories of some of the things that she's seen that happened to relatives and friends that I think, you know, they're kind of permanent scars. And to their credit, you know, I don't think they hate anybody, but I think that they have been scarred by those experiences.
Did they make remarks? I mean, you said you thought your parents were racist. Did they make remarks?
Not my parents, my father more than
your father more. But would he say things?
Yes. Yeah, he would say things. He would say he would say things out of pain, you know. He would say things that reflected his experience in this country, trying to be a man and try to raise his family and being discriminated against in the way that he was. You know, he was, because he had no education, he was at the bottom of the barrel of a lot of things. But he was a brilliant man. He was a very creative person. And I think that was a great torture for him.
Let me ask you about another part of your career. You first got into theater just by acting. How did you get then from acting to directing? What was the transition there?
Well, I started out as a stage director and couldn't get arrested. You know, I just couldn't survive. You know, I was working in New York directing my own plays and plays for other people, and I never made over $3,000 a year, you know, just an unemployment and the rest of it and just going downhill. And so I started acting, and that helped. I was in a Broadway play for like a year, but I still wanted to direct. But the equipment of film was very intimidating to me. I went away to BU and got into, you know, theater courses, and then came back to New York again, and then came out to California. And I was in a series on television for two seasons called Palmerstown USA. And I thought I was going to, you know, I'd made it. I was co-starring in it, and then the series ended, and I didn't work for 2 years. And then I made a 45-minute short called The Hero, which won some awards, and I tried to shop it around to studios for a couple of years. No one would buy it, or no one would hire me as director. And then I was at a meditation retreat in Calistoga, and I was meditating. My agent called me, and he said, "They want you to do a Knots Landing." I thought, I couldn't believe it. And so I came back, and I met the producer, David Jacobs. He says, "I want you to do this, you know, this project." And so I was prepping. My first Knots Landing, I was prepping. And the last day of prep, which was the seventh day, Joe Wallenstein, the producer, called me to his office, and he said, "You know, I like your prep and your good luck tomorrow, but I could tell you're going to be great from your reel." I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I don't have a reel." He says, "What are you talking?" I said, "All I have is a short film from AFI." So he runs out of the office, and he comes back, and what had happened was they had mixed my film up with a reel from a director. And they wanted to fire me on the spot. But it was the last day of prep, and they couldn't. And so I went through and directed the Knots Landing, and then they gave me a second one, and that's how my career started.
You mentioned earlier that when you were doing television, you were living very well, living in a Frank Lloyd Wright house and having new Mercedes Benz.
Oh, it's a Lloyd Wright house. It's his son.
Lloyd Wright. Oh.
Not quite Frank yet.
Oh, okay.
But,
son of Frank.
Son of Frank's house.
Son of Frank Lloyd Wright's house. And also driving a Mercedes Benz, a new one every couple of years. Where do you live now, and what do you drive now?
Well,
how much have you dropped? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, you know, I live in a rented house in the Pacific Palisades that I like very much, and nice ocean view. And I have a Lexus car, and it's less important to me now. I think, you know, as I'm older, my focus is more on. I want to make a couple of great films before I get out of here. You know, I really want to make a few films that really communicate something that is important and that affect people and in a way that's significant.
Well, I thank you very much, Bill Duke, for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
This is very pleasant, and I really appreciate it.
Bill Duke's new film is called The Cemetery Club. I'm Artie Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.